some insight today on just what Jerome Powell is thinking, the Fed chair on Capitol Hill, also some new research on immigration, and a look at changes in the grocery aisle. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From Washington, D.C., I'm Kimberly Adams in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Wednesday, July the 10th. Good to have you with us. Two data points from the U.S. Central Bank today, both sending strong and consistent messages about monetary policy. First, we got the minutes from the Federal Reserve's meeting back in June. And the second, Chair Jerome Powell himself testified this morning before the House Financial Services Committee. He does this twice a year. He'll speak to the Senate tomorrow. Gina Smilek from The New York Times is with us in studio to talk about what we're hearing from the Fed. Thanks for joining us.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for having me.
So for those of us who aren't avid Fed watchers, what were the highlights today in Chair Powell's testimony?
The big headline that people are going to take away from this is that the Fed seems to be setting up for a July rate cut, which is a big deal because they haven't cut rates since the depths of the financial crisis. So it's been about a decade. And so that's the big one. The other one I think that's important is the Fed is really highlighting that they're worried about slow price increases right now, just because that increases the risk that they don't hit their inflation goal, increasing the risk of deflation in the next crisis.
Did you see any difference between what Chair Powell was saying on the Hill today versus what kind of came out in the minutes?
No, I think the big takeaway is actually that they were very much in agreement. So in the minutes, Fed officials basically told us that they are watching a bunch of uncertainties from the trade war to slowing global growth. And as they watch those, they're thinking that it might be appropriate to cut rates in the near term. And then Chair Powell went up on the Hill and basically said, those uncertainties, they are still here. They are still with us. They are looming. They haven't dissipated. And I think a lot of folks are saying that means July is a go.
So let's talk about expectations for a minute. The markets are already pricing in that rate cut that you're talking about. President Trump is effectively demanding one. How much wiggle room does Powell really have here in deciding on a rate cut?
Yeah, so I think probably less after today, simply because market pricing is pretty cemented at this point. You know, they really chose not to walk back those expectations during both these minutes, which are edited after the fact and sort of, you know, in anticipation
massage
of markets reading them. And also in Chair Powell's remarks, if he had wanted to pull that back, he would have done it, and he did not.
Powell also made clear in his testimony today that he wants to do whatever he can to keep this record economic expansion going. And one of the reasons he mentioned is because that expansion still has not reached everyone. A lot of folks aren't feeling this quote unquote good economy.
And the big point there is wage growth. It just hasn't taken off the way you would expect if companies were really fighting with each other for workers. And so I think what the Fed is looking at is, you know, can we continue running this pretty tight labor market with very low unemployment without stoking higher wages? And the answer that they're coming up with as they ask themselves that question is probably yes. And probably that's going to help lift people who haven't really benefited from this very strong economy.
So just very quickly for our own economic intelligence, what does a rate cut do for that situation?
Right. So what it does is just sustain the economic expansion longer so that people can keep hiring, companies can keep hiring, and everyday workers who might have been on the sidelines can jump into jobs.
Which gets to what our colleague Sabri Benishore is going to get to in a second on labor force participation. Gina Smilek is from The New York Times. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So staying with the Fed news for a bit longer, one of the other topics that came up was just that, labor force participation. Out of all the Americans out there who are of working age, how many of them are actually working or looking for work? Right now, it's just under 63% of people, which historically is pretty low. Fed Chair Powell is concerned enough about it that he mentioned it directly in his testimony before Congress today.
Labor force participation by those in their prime working years is now lower in the United States than in most other nations with comparable economies.
Marketplace's Sabri Benishore takes a look at what's going on with that and why it matters.
There are 80 million Americans 25 to 54 years old, what the government calls prime working age. Think of them as potential providers. Think of them as potential fuel for the U.S. economy. Not as many of them are working or looking for work as are in countries with similar economies.
It's a major problem.
Harry Holzer is a labor economist at Georgetown.
There's a story for women and a story for men.
Women almost single-handedly electrified the labor force in the U.S. after World War II. They started working in droves in the 50s and 60s, and then...
Since that time, the labor force participation of women has topped out.
Joe Minerick is Senior Vice President at the Committee for Economic Development. In other countries, women's participation has continued to increase. Minerick says one possible explanation is that women in the U.S. sometimes have to choose between expensive child care and leaving work to care for their kids themselves. In other developed economies, women don't always face quite the same stark choice.
Access to preschool education or to child care in other countries is in some instances stronger.
There's a segment of men too, less educated men without a lot of skills or training who've been drifting out of the workforce over the past three decades. And then there is the opioid epidemic. Mark Schweitzer is a senior vice president at the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland.
We find that places that had more opioid prescriptions are likely to have weaker labor markets and in particular lower labor force participation rates.
The good news is that the labor market has gotten so tight recently that it continues to lure more and more workers back into the workforce. The bad news, they're still not back to pre-recession levels. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
By the way, the next Fed meeting is on July 30th and 31st. In the meantime, we've got a timeline on what the Fed has done with interest rates, as well as the tools the Fed has on hand to help with those decisions. You can find all of that and more on Marketplace.org. Wall Street liked all that Fed news that Gina was talking about. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. At first, folks were cutting the cord to save money on their cable bill. Now, with dozens of different streaming services, it's getting harder to see those savings and just to keep track of what you can watch where. Well, that selection just got a bit more difficult. AT&T's Warner Media announced yesterday its new HBO Max will be ready next spring. The new streaming service will include some classic TV shows and also some splashy, big-budget productions. As Marketplace's Andy Euler reports, these days, media companies are spending big bucks to draw people to their particular corner of the streaming universe.
Soon, if you want to watch Friends, you're going to have to do it on HBO Max. The show is leaving Netflix. HBO Max says it'll also have more than a dozen original shows with movie stars like Nicole Kidman. The platform is betting on original content.
The stakes have gotten very high, and producing a lot of high-quality original content is not an inexpensive proposition.
That's Paul Sweeting at Concurrent Media. He says one show looms large over this business.
If you look at what HBO was spending on Game of Thrones, you know, that had to be $10 or $15 million per episode. And if you did a 10-episode season, that's $150 million. That's a major motion picture.
Every streaming service would love a Game of Thrones. What's happening is streaming services are aiming to become the home for big-budget scripted shows that used to be more of a big-screen thing. Michael Pachter is a research analyst at Wedbush Securities.
That $50 million box office romantic comedy that used to dominate in the 1990s and early 2000s just isn't even made anymore. You remember guys like Rob Lowe used to be movie stars and now they're TV stars.
Netflix says it can use the money it no longer has to spend on shows like Friends to produce even more proprietary content, expensive originals like Stranger Things. All well and good, but Paul Sweeting at Concurrent Media says there's a risk to such a big investment.
One of the challenges that I think these companies are going to face is subscription fatigue.
$10 here, $15 there, it adds up. But Jason Squire at USC says more competition will ultimately be a good thing.
It's a golden opportunity for consumers because they will have far more choices and the decisions are in their hands.
So he says it's up to you if you want to pay for Netflix and Hulu and Amazon and HBO Max, which is likely to come in north of $15 a month. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace. We'll be right back.
There is a humanitarian crisis on the southern border, and it's directly related to the fact Congress and the White House can't come to an agreement on how to overhaul our immigration system. President Trump released an immigration proposal back in May, which would shift policy from a focus on family-based immigration to more skills-based immigration. Both Republicans and Democrats say the president's plan is going nowhere, but it's worth revisiting today because there's a report out from the New American Economy, a bipartisan research think tank. They dug into immigration data and found that a majority of immigrants coming to America in recent years are already highly educated and skilled. Andrew Lim is director of quantitative research at the NAE. Mr. Lim, welcome to the program.
Hey, great to be here. Thank you.
So you looked at immigrants who came to the country in 2017. When it comes to educational background, what was the breakdown of that group?
So in terms of the breakdown of the group, we saw that immigrants in 2017 really had much higher educational attainment levels than the overall population of the United States or even immigrants in general. About 53% of immigrants that came that year had at least a bachelor's degree. And that includes almost 25% of that total who had an advanced degree. So that's a master's, a law or medical degree, or a doctorate.
And is this all immigrants, including people who came seeking asylum or came here illegally?
These are all people who we estimate to be here with documentation. That could include people here on temporary work visas, people who have come as refugees or asylees, or people who are here as green card holders.
So what sorts of skills or experiences specifically does this, especially the group of highly educated immigrants, bring in?
So about 28% of immigrants who came that year had a degree in STEM. So STEM meaning science, technology, engineering, or math-related fields. That means that they were able to work in these really critical STEM jobs that the United States is really seeing incredible growth in. So the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics estimates that STEM jobs are second only to healthcare jobs as the most fastest-growing set of jobs in the U.S. economy from now until 2026.
And there's research showing there are labor shortages in those higher-skilled jobs.
Yeah, I think even if we're looking at 2017 data and you see that about 143,000 of these immigrants had STEM degrees, if you actually look at the size of the shortage, so in 2018, so the year after this data, the Smithsonian Institute actually estimated that there were 2.4 million STEM jobs that went unfilled. So even with this fairly significant number of incoming immigrants with that skill set, there was still an enormous gap between the supply of skilled and appropriate workers with the demand.
How would the group of immigrants you studied, the people who came in 2017, fare under President Trump's recent immigration proposal?
Well, for the ones that have the highest levels of education, I think there's a decent shot that they would get in. I just think that it makes it much harder. It's a much different system. And so right now it's really untested at a time when the U.S. economy is really needing more workers of all different skill levels. And given, you know, the sort of unprecedented period of economic growth that we've had and the extremely tight labor markets, especially in certain states, you know, especially ones that are perhaps not on the coast, that don't receive a lot of people, that aren't seeing a retention of their U.S.-born population as well, you're seeing really critical labor shortages in all different sectors of the economy, not just the high-skilled sectors. So that kind of immigration system isn't really taking into account the full needs of the U.S. economy.
But one of the arguments often raised for reducing even high-skilled immigration is that these are jobs that native-born Americans could fill if they had the right training.
If you look at businesses, you know, tend to need workers when they need them. I know that's sort of simplistic to say, but training does take time. I think that any smart sort of education and economic policy on a domestic scale would include that kind of retraining for workers who are interested in doing it. But really, these kinds of shortages are critical in the moment for businesses. A business can't wait around for 2 or 4 years for a set of workers to finish their training, to have the right amount of or the right level of skills to fill those sort of specialty occupations. So immigration is sort of a stopgap for this immense shortage that we have right now. It's not, you know, the be-all, end-all solution to this shortage of labor, but it is, you know, a critical piece of that puzzle.
Andrew Lim is Director of Quantitative Research at the think tank New American Economy. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Coming up,
the American supermarket has roughly like 40,000 items.
And those items reflect our changing tastes. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 76 points, more than 0.25%, to close at 26,860. The NASDAQ up 60 points, 0.75%, to finish at 8202. And the S&P 500 boosted 13 points, 0.4%, to end at 2993. With the Fed hinting at an interest rate cut, J.P. Morgan Chase trickled down more than 0.25%. Goldman Sachs fell 0.8%. Boeing is losing its place as the world's largest plane maker to Airbus. Boeing decelerated 0.2%. Jeans maker Levi Strauss said its sales growth may slow down in the second half of the year. Levi's unzipped 12%. Bonds held steady. The yield on the 10-year T-note stayed at 2.06%. And you're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kimberly Adams. Jobs at distribution centers, those mega warehouses used by e-commerce companies, have a certain reputation that the hours are long and the jobs are demanding. But lately, there are some warehouse designers that want to change that reputation by making the warehouse look a little different, adding amenities like coffee shops, gyms, and so on. And there's a reason why. Keiko Morris wrote about it for The Wall Street Journal. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start out by describing what today's mega distribution centers look like. Can you paint a picture for me?
Today's distribution center is a pretty sophisticated production floor, but it's housed in sort of a more, I would call it utilitarian structure, right? Four walls, a roof, maybe the front office has windows. That's what we've got today.
So it's not exactly the kind of place where you might find a gym or ping pong tables in the rec room.
No. So what I did in this story, I was talking to developers and started to notice that there was a small but growing number of developers who were adding amenities that I wish I would have at my office.
In your story, you describe plans to make one Atlanta warehouse that would have an employee soccer field and other things. Do you want to tell me about that one in particular?
Yes, that was kind of the property that had the most amenities and was kind of the most surprising. It's a property where ASOS, a UK online retailer, has created a 1 million square foot warehouse, and they have everything from soccer pitch. They had a temporary pop-up space where they brought in a nail salon, barbershop. They've got I guess it would be sort of a canteen where they've got all sorts of food stations. You really don't see that. Oftentimes, the place where workers eat, you might have a couple of vending machines. One is probably broken, and you've got like a card table and aluminum chairs. This was like a warehouse with amenities on steroids.
So why would companies add these things? What's the strategy here?
Basically, you've got these folks competing for labor. And you've also got online shopping continuing to expand. And you've got a pretty competitive, tight labor market.
Are these the kinds of changes that workers in these distribution centers actually want? I mean, what were you hearing from them?
When I called and talked to worker advocates and talked to a few workers themselves, they were actually surprised to hear of these warehouses. And, you know, they said, sure, we'd like these amenities, but really the vast majority of warehouses don't look like the warehouses that I highlighted in my story. I spoke to one worker who basically said, I don't know that I really need a coffee bar or a gym in the warehouse where I work. I'd rather have health insurance.
Why are some companies making the decision to invest in these kind of amenities rather than things like better benefits?
So, I mean, some companies are actually raising wages, but there's only so much they can invest, or they say they want to invest. And so they think that the other way that they can attract workers, good workers, is to say, here's an environment that's got really nice lunch services, you know, which to workers is money. So that's kind of where they're coming at it from.
Keiko Morris covers commercial real estate for the Wall Street Journal. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Think about the last time you went to the grocery store. You're walking down the aisles. What do you see on the shelves? How different is that from what you might have seen 5, 10, 20 years ago? Nowadays, there's a greater variety of items, especially when it comes to Asian cuisine. Some professional cooks who specialize in Asian dishes are enjoying the rising interest in their food. That gets us to our latest installment of My Economy.
My name is Andrea Nguyen, and I am a cookbook author and cooking teacher. Nowadays, I think for a lot of Asian cookbook authors like myself, Asian food has this influence now that it has never really enjoyed across the board. So we're living in a really great time for global cuisines, and you know, Asian flavors are part of that, and I'm so happy to be here now. I don't think that I would have been as successful as today, because nowadays you have color photography, you have social media, and I can keep pushing ideas and techniques and put it in front of people's eyes more often. In the mid-70s when we got here, the American supermarket was relatively, you know, limited. There were, say, 9,000 to 10,000 ingredients in supermarkets. So the inventory seemed like it was vast to me because I was a kid. But in the scheme of things, it turns out it wasn't, because nowadays, the American supermarket has roughly like 40,000 items, and they're much larger imprints, you know, like footprints. And so when we go to the American supermarket today, we are looking at really the changing American interest in global foods and preparing them, also buying prepared foods that are, you know, you reheat, like Korean barbecue, for example. But, you know, to take a look at the international food section, it just is so exciting to me to see Asian food, South Asian food. Sometimes I've seen a section on Mexican American food versus authentic Mexican food. It just depends on where you're shopping. And that's really indicative of where we are in terms of this country's interest in a diversity of flavors at their table.
This series is all about you. So share your story with us. Head on over to marketplace.org. And if you're now craving some Vietnamese food yourself, we've also got some of Andrea Nguyen's recipes on our site. This final note on the way out, New York City welcomed the World Cup champion U.S. women's soccer team back to the States with a ticker tape parade today. But wait, ticker tape? As the Wall Street Journal pointed out, no one really uses ticker tape anymore. The machines that used the long ribbons of paper were once a staple in newsrooms and on stock trading floors. Think ticker symbol. And old ticker tape was handy when you needed some confetti. Now, according to the journal, they just use shredded paper from the recycling bin. But it's still a cool effect. Congratulations to the team. There's actually an old ticker tape machine in the Marketplace waiting room in Los Angeles. I tweeted a photo of it if you want to see what one looks like. I'm at KA_Marketplace. And look at the time. Today, the Dow rose 76 points, more than 0.25%. The NASDAQ up 60 points, 0.75%. And the S&P 500 boosted 13 points, 0.4%. Our media production team includes Sarah Bruguer, Drew Jostad, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday. And I'm Kimberly Adams, in for Kai Rizdahl. Kai returns tomorrow. We'll be right back. This is APM.